From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. New data bring another injection of good news for one of the world's top coronavirus vaccine makers. We're learning today that Pfizer's two-dose vaccine provides protection for at least 6 months and appears to be effective against the variant first discovered in South Africa. At the same time, a setback. Johnson & Johnson said a manufacturing mix-up has ruined 15 million doses of its vaccine. Let's check in with Dr. Lena Wen, professor of public health at George Washington University and an emergency room physician. She joins us on Skype. Dr. Wen, welcome back.
Great to join you. Thank you.
So Pfizer said today its vaccines are going to work for at least 6 months and protect against that South Africa variant. Are you encouraged?
Very much so. So there are two pieces of good data here. One is that the vaccine looks like it's protective for at least 6 months. I think that's important to emphasize. We're not saying that it's effective for only 6 months, but because these are new vaccines, it's hard to say exactly how long they're effective for. Most likely, they're effective for quite a bit longer than that, maybe even a couple of years. But at least we know that they're effective for that six-month period. Then you mentioned about the variant in South Africa, the B1351 variant. This Pfizer trial, part of it was also looking at what happened in South Africa, where that B1351 variant was dominant, and it showed that this vaccine is very efficacious in preventing infections there too. So good news all around.
Interesting. Now, you say it could work for a couple of years. We just don't know yet. But this new data do make me wonder, you know, whether or not we are going to be getting a COVID shot every year, the way we do with seasonal flu. What do you think about that?
I think it's possible. I think it's possible that we may need to get booster shots that specifically target new developing variants, different strains that that may come up. It may also be that we need to get this as an annual or once every 2 year shot, which I know doesn't sound particularly pleasant, but I would say also that this is a once in a generation pandemic that has killed more than 500,000 people here in the US. And so if what it's going to take is for us to get regular shots, I think it's worth it in order to end this pandemic.
It has been a good week for Pfizer, I have to say. Yesterday, we learned its vaccine works on kids as young as 12 and works very well. Earlier this week, the CDC said real-world data show that Pfizer and Moderna's vaccines were up to 90% effective at preventing injections. But then on the other hand, there's Johnson & Johnson, millions of doses spoiled because of a manufacturing error. What happened and how out of the ordinary is a mistake like that?
Yeah, so I first want to emphasize that the Johnson & Johnson error that occurred does not affect any of the Johnson & Johnson vaccines that are currently in circulation here in the U.S. Those vaccines were actually manufactured in a plant in Europe, and so is not affected at all by the news that came out yesterday. I mean, I think this emphasizes why vaccine development is not straightforward. Vaccine manufacturing, manufacturing development is very complicated, and things could go wrong in that process. But this is the reason why we have a very strict regulatory process. And I think the American people should be reassured that the safeguards that need to be applied are working. And again, be reassured that everything that's currently in circulation is totally fine.
Now, we're hearing from the Biden administration that this mix-up will not impact the government's promise to get everybody a vaccine by the end of May. Do you agree? Will it have an impact on the way we get these shots out the door and into people's arms?
Look, the Biden administration certainly has insight into vaccine supply, and if they're confident that every American or that there's going to be enough supply for every American by the end of May, I think that's really fantastic news. I am worried about the next step, which is I think at some point very soon, the supply is going to catch up with demand. And the main problem moving forward is not having enough vaccine, but making vaccine access convenient and easy, because I think we focus so much on talking about vaccine hesitancy. And yes, that is a real issue. But I think a lot of the issue, too, is it just is hard for people to get a vaccine, to sign up and to wait for a long time to try to navigate these vaccine sites. So we need to get vaccines to people in workplaces, in churches, in schools. That's what we should really be focused on.
Well, you know, you make a good point, Dr. Wen. We've been talking to health officials in states around the country recently in Alaska, Oklahoma. These are states that are now opening their vaccines to people who are 16 years of age and older. On the surface, it sounds like a good thing, right? But we're also hearing from those places that one of the reasons that's happening is because there's some hesitancy and not enough people are signing up for the shots.
Right. And we have to address that hesitancy. We have to answer people's questions and address their concerns. But I also think that there are millions of people who may not actually be hesitant, but who are working multiple jobs, who are caring for their parents and young children, it's just going to be hard for them to actually sign up to get a vaccine. And so that's why the additional focus on making sure that there is vaccine available in every doctor's office, in every community pharmacy, what President Biden has said about having people go no more than 5 miles to get a vaccine. I actually think people should not have to go more than half a mile to get a vaccine. Hmm. We really need people to have vaccine available so that vaccination becomes the easy and convenient choice to protect oneself and people around them too.
Dr. Lena Wen, professor of public health at George Washington University, also author of the forthcoming book, Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Doctor, thanks for all you do. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
While you could describe the collective mood in the U.S. as cautiously optimistic, France is going into a third national lockdown to try to stop skyrocketing COVID-19 infections. Schools and almost all stores will be closed, domestic travel limited, and a nightly curfew will continue. It's a move French President Emmanuel Macron had resisted for weeks, despite increasingly desperate calls for action by the doctors in the country's hardest-pressed hospitals. France has not had a good record of dealing with the pandemic, more than 93,000 deaths already, and another 1,000 people dying each week. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joins us from Paris. Eleanor, before this, President Macron's government had been stressing a regional approach to dealing with the pandemic. What changed?
Well, what changed is now these new variants are dominant, especially the UK variant, and they're spreading very fast and they're very deadly. So now just, you know, a 7 p.m. nationwide curfew and regional lockdowns are not working. Macron spoke to the nation last night. Here he is.
Si nous faisons ce choix de toucher tout le territoire métropolitain,
so he said, you know, if we're choosing to close down the whole country, it's because no area of the country is spared. Everywhere the virus is spreading faster and faster, and everywhere hospitalizations are rising. Macron called it a race. He said on one side is the vaccine, which gives us hope to get out of this crisis. And on the other side is the propagation of new virus variants spreading across Europe that are more deadly than ever. He called what's happening now with these new variants an epidemic within the epidemic.
Wow. So that's the public health dimension. But what about the economy? I mean, what are the likely effects of another shutdown?
Well, disastrous, of course. You know, bars and restaurants have been closed here since October. You know, stores were allowed to open in December through March 18th, and then regions went into lockdown. But now they're closed across the country, all businesses, with a few exceptions, of course, grocery stores. And that means that's 150,000 businesses, up from 90,000. The French government is now spending 11 billion euros a month. That's $13 billion, you know, propping businesses up. That support is to keep, you know, companies from laying people off, to keep them on the payrolls, like in hotels, in the tourism industry, in restaurants. People aren't going to work, but they're being kept on the payrolls to avoid mass layoffs. And, you know, now with schools and daycares closed, some people who have to go out to their jobs can't anymore. So the government has promised to support them as well. So, you know, the debt's going to be huge. It's now been a year. How many of these places will never open up again? But I think, you know, it's all going to have to end and the dust is going to have to clear for us to see just the scale of it. But it's disastrous for the economy.
Yeah. And in the meantime, Eleanor, how are the French people responding? I mean, you've been tweeting pictures of people gathering in crowds, not wearing masks. It seems like people are tiring of these restrictions.
Yeah, I went walking on the Seine River yesterday, and I was very shocked by a group of young people, exactly how you described. But it's mostly the young people without the masks. I think they're the most frustrated because they haven't felt the effect of this pandemic. But the government has been stressing that ICUs are now full of younger and younger people hit by these new variants. And many of them have no underlying health problems at all. And I would say most of the other people are wearing masks. And yes, people are tired of it, but we know that it's not going to be over until everyone does this hard work. So I think the French, you know, in the hopes of having a somewhat normal summer, they know they have to lock down now. And actually, polls show that many faulted President Macron for not closing down the country earlier.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, there is a political component to this, right? I mean, as you say, some people blame the president for not locking down earlier. He has defended his strategy, and now he faces a presidential election next year. So is this latest lockdown kind of an admission of failure on his part?
Well, he wouldn't say that, but he did defend. Yes, he defended last night, not locking down earlier. He said the French, unlike their neighbors, had gained more classroom days, more work days, and more days of freedom. He's had some tension with scientists because they actually called on him to lock down earlier. Macron was clearly hoping the vaccine would save him from having to do a third national lockdown. And many say he's failed, like far-right leader Marine Le Pen, and polls show her rising, and she's likely to be his main opponent next year. So, yeah, many would say he's failed, although I doubt he would at this point.
All right, that's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley speaking with us from Paris, where another lockdown is going to affect as there's another spike in COVID-19 infections. Eleanor, thank you.
Thank you.
Vietnamese-American Julian Saparidi is not only a serious historian, he's also a musician. He's trying to use his new album to get you thinking about this country's complicated past. His musical project No No Boy tells stories rooted in his own family history. Here's the song, Saint-Denis.
A soft language barrier, a child of an immigrant. Before the banh mi trucks were cool, table embarrassment.
No No Boy's new album is called 1975, and Julian Saparidi joins us now. Welcome.
It's great to be here and have a chance to talk. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Tell me more about your family.
Yeah, well, it's an all-over-the-world kind of family. On my mom's side, we come from Vietnam, and specifically she was raised in South Vietnam before the country reunified in 75, and most of my family went to France. She got scattered to the United States along with a couple other family members and wound up in Tennessee because my dad, who's from Boston originally, comes from Italian heritage, is a music business guy and wound up in Nashville. So that's how I, as a Italian-American, Vietnamese-American kid, grew up with a very interesting existence in country music USA.
My home, I wish I had taken French a little more seriously. I remember singing to you when you were dying in Saint-Denis.
Well, let's talk about No No Boy. This is the name of your musical project. It is a phrase that has roots in the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Can you explain a little bit more and why that resonated with you?
So one of the great Asian American novels that was overlooked forever is called No No Boy by John Okada. And it got at this character who was one of these historical no-no boys who refused to swear allegiance to the United States and to serve in the army while his family was incarcerated in these American concentration camps. And there was this torn intuitiveness of this character when he returned home from federal prison. I just had never read anything that was Asian American that got at this torn intuitiveness, which I think a lot of people who are immigrants or children of immigrants can feel both in your own quote-unquote community of your nationality or your race, but also within broader American society. So like for me growing up in Tennessee, that torn intuitiveness was really, I don't know, what I keep coming back to is describing how I grew up. And at the same time, you know, the title of the project's just a trick to get people to Google No No Boy and then read a good book. So it's yeah, Trojan horse, yeah, so to speak.
Yeah. You actually use that phrase Trojan horse a lot. In fact, I think the lyrics in many of these songs you describe as a Trojan horse to get people to talk about something else or to learn about something else. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was kind of looking around the academic landscape and thought, what are different ways to get this really important history? The idea that in 1882, all Chinese people were excluded by government law from the United States up to the Vietnam War, the Cambodian genocide. How can I bring these really heavy and now very politically fraught subjects to the people that raised me? You know, this, the conservative folks in the middle of the country, and not come at it with argument, but rather, hey, this stuff happened. Some of this stuff happened in my own family. Let me just tell you what I've seen, what I've witnessed, what my family's experienced, what I've studied, and maybe we can talk about it. By using music instead of argument, I think you can get more people to the table. And also get people maybe more emotionally invested. If they dig the music, the lyrics can kind of then weave their way in.
Yeah. Well, to that point, let's listen to a song on the new album that directly talks about the internment camps that you were discussing. This is called The Best Dam Band in Wyoming, and that's lightly edited for the radio there. Let's listen.
Georgie Gawa, Oji Nise, he tore up the coast and even played Japan. Before the war, they ripped up the Florida ballroom and don't sleep on the Shotokians.
George Igawa and his band, the George Igawa Orchestra, they actually were a real jazz band. Tell me about them, and is that like an example of the Trojan horse you're talking about?
The George Igawa Orchestra was this jazz band that formed in a World War II concentration camp in Wyoming, in this state where I lived for a good portion of my adult life. And when I found a picture of them in the archives, I was just blown away because they had instruments. This is coming from a kid who went to music college and literally studied jazz history and never heard about any Asians playing jazz or Asian Americans, let alone an entire 16-piece big band that formed in a concentration camp and then was let out from behind the barbed wire only to play concerts and then rounded up and put back in after every show. And for me, yeah, the Trojan Horse thing, we can go there with that because that's a huge, heavy history. 10 concentration camps, barbed wire, guard towers. But if we go in and we find commonality, which for me, you know, George Igawa, like, that's an Asian American musician who lived in Wyoming. That's a lineage.
Yeah, look, I want to ask you about something else. The sound is very important for you in this album. I understand that you traveled a lot to create field recordings, which you then incorporated into the music. Why was that something that was important to you?
Yeah, so I mean, I have a love of field recording. I'd always have my little Zoom recorder and just be picking up the sound of a barrack or down at the detention centers at the U.S.-Mexico border where I've worked a lot in the last couple of years, the sound of the barbed wire, the sound of like wood planks at the Angel Island immigration station outside San Francisco. And these became samples that I turned into basically drum kits, which every song you hear on the album, there's no actual studio percussion except for a couple tambourines. And the rest is just these samples that have been mutated and shifted around to become the rhythm that I actually perform the songs over. And that's really important to me because it's the sound of the past. It's the sound of history. We're often, when we look back at history, we kind of put it on mute. I want to know what the sound of the environment was.
Well, it sounds good. I mean, at one point, you actually are banging on an empty tank, a really big empty tank. And then you take that sound and it becomes a part of one of your songs.
Yeah, that's you're referring to this big tank by the old pool at the Crystal City concentration camp, which housed German, Italian, and Japanese. And now all that's really left is this basin of an old pool, and there's a big tank, and it makes the most amazing reverb. And that's right in the middle of my song called Sand Creek that's on the album.
Open up your eyes, pen to paper, take a trip, my love, let me know what you find. Open up your eyes, open up your eyes.
You mentioned going down to the U.S.-Mexico border. Let's listen to a song about that. This is Close Your Eyes and Dream of Flowers.
Right. Imagine taking a tanker ship, then walking all of Mexico. I know some people who the blues won't quit. Imagine no end to a road.
Make the connection between what you saw at the southern border with this conversation we've been having about being an Asian immigrant in this country.
It's more of that connection of refugees. So the stories my mom told me about coming over, or that other Vietnamese Americans have told me about coming over to the U.S. or France or wherever, escaping re-education camps or war, having to survive these horrifying journeys. There's echoes in the stories I hear and the things I witnessed down in Matamoros at the refugee camp in Mexico, or in Brownsville, or in Laredo, or Nuevo Laredo. And while we have to use historical specificity when we talk about all these places, it'd be good to kind of find that common ground. Going back and finding that place of empathy in your own story might make you a little bit more empathetic to what's happening down in Texas right now.
Well, exactly. And I'm listening to you talk about your experience at the border and this conversation we've been having about discrimination against Asian Americans. And I'm kind of overwhelmed, really, by how relevant it is right now with the crisis at the border and with the shootings in the Atlanta area. I mean, you never could have known this album would come out at such a moment. But what does it say to you that it did?
You got to understand that Atlanta is not new. Atlanta is just the latest skip on a broken record of Asian American massacres in this country. Going back to Rock Springs, Wyoming, 1885, one of the worst mass lynchings that ever happened was in LA to Chinese folks back in the late 1800s. The idea that there's a rise in anti-Asian sentiment is questionable. It's more that there's an awareness now, which I'm very grateful for. And so I hope this album and these stories might help people contextualize Atlanta and contextualize the border within a larger American history. But to answer your question, it's like I'd really rather not promote anything that has anything to do with the subject matter right now because it just feels weird and icky. But, you know, I appreciate the time. And I hope someone reads an article instead of just, you know, hashtagging because of this conversation we're having.
Historian and musician Julian Saporiti, also known as No-No Boy. The new album is 1975. Julian, thank you very much for having this conversation with us. I do appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much. I really appreciate you all, and stay safe and drink water while we're going through this.
Good advice.
Twice seven with two civil wars. Fool to think that this place could ever be yours. The in-between, that's where we must explore. Tell Hanoi I love her. Jamie's mother in the nail salon. Bedazzled star, spangled t-shirt, tiger mom. Saw the flag on my hat, told me to take it off. Tell Hanoi I love her.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about TV, movies, and more, like the new Marvel Disney Plus series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and a definitive ranking of the best Muppets. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Yes, please do. Take me out to the ball game. It is baseball's opening day, and fans are rooting for this season to be better than the last. The plan is for a full 162-game schedule after the pandemic-shortened 60-game season in 2020 when opening day didn't happen until mid-July. It will not be business as usual, though. There's still a pandemic. Though 30 teams were supposed to play today, one game has already been canceled because of COVID. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock is in Boston. And Alex, we were supposed to be speaking with you from Fenway Park, but you got rained out.
Yeah, I had my rain gear all ready. We knew it was going to be rainy today. It rained all night and all morning, and the Red Sox decided to cancel their home opener against the Orioles. That was supposed to be played this afternoon. Hopefully it'll be played tomorrow when it's supposed to be sunny and in the 40s here, so a little chilly, but it'll be baseball.
So you lost that game to weather, but we also lost one to COVID. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the Washington Nationals game against the Mets in New York tonight has been postponed. That's because the Nationals were down five players because of one positive test on the team. The others had been in contact with that player. MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred is telling ESPN that the game will be played on Friday. This was bound to happen, I think, Peter, because as you know, there were teams during the shortened season last year that really had to shut down because they had COVID issues. So it's happening already, and the season hasn't even started.
Deja vu already now. How are major league teams going to deal with fans and attendance at their stadiums when they do have the games going on?
Well, the first thing is fans are back. There were no fans in the stadiums last year. Reduced capacity at most ballparks here in Boston. They'll have about 4,500 fans. Wrigley Field in Chicago, about 8,000 fans when the Cubs play the Pirates today. There will be some bigger crowds, though, in Colorado when the Rockies host the Dodgers. More than 20,000 fans are expected for that game. And when the Texas Rangers play their home opener, Peter, on Monday, they'll be greeted by a full house, 40,000 fans. So everybody in attendance.
And I think that's the only one in baseball. Now, Joe Biden, President Biden, was actually asked about that on ESPN last night. He's not a fan of that decision. Here's what he said.
Well, that's a decision they made. I think it's a mistake. They should listen to Dr. Fauci and the scientists and the experts.
Biden also urged players to get vaccinated, and Major League Baseball is doing the same thing. Teams that are 85% vaccinated would have some safety protocols loosened. For example, they could gather in hotels without a mask.
Yeah, that's right. And I should mention here that baseball stadiums across the country have been vaccination sites all along. And Major League Baseball says a million people have gotten vaccinations at ballparks so far.
All right. Well, players and staff still going to have to follow some COVID rules there. But let's go back to the fans that are coming into the stadiums. How's that going to work? Just walk in, watch the game?
Well, let's listen quickly to Doug Behar. He's the stadium manager at Yankee Stadium, and he's talking about the fan experience this season.
The experience, of course, will be a little bit different. We encourage all fans to get here early. There is a testing requirement in New York. So fans will have to show up with either a negative COVID test or proof of vaccination. There will be temperature checks as well.
It's the first day of baseball here now. Alex Ashlock, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Peter.
In Georgia, a bill overhauling the state's citizen arrest law is now on its way to Republican Governor Brian Kemp, who has signaled that he'll sign it. The repeal passed with near unanimous bipartisan support in both chambers of the state legislature this week. The citizen's arrest law, which dates from the Civil War era, allowed people to make an arrest if they witness a crime. For decades, the law was often used to justify the lynching of black people. And last year, a prosecutor cited the law in initially refusing to charge three white men involved in the shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery. Arbery was a black man out for a jog when he was killed. The three men were later charged with Arbery's murder after an investigation. Supporters are calling the repeal of the citizen's arrest law a landmark for racial justice in Georgia.
We're continuing our conversation about ways students and educators have adapted since COVID-19 hit last year, and we're talking about their visions for post-pandemic learning. Last week, we heard from Jer View. He's a guidance counselor at Roseville Area High School in Roseville, Minnesota. And today, we're going to Paul Quinn College. It's a historically black college in Dallas, Texas, where students are still working through virtual learning. Joining us on Skype is the school's president, Michael Sorrell. Welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
We're glad to have you. And I have to say, one of the things that sticks with me from the conversation that we had with the guidance counselor last week is his conclusion that a one-size-fits-all approach to instruction just doesn't make sense. And we talked about how some students have thrived in online classes while others have struggled, which underscores this reality that there are different learning styles. So I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, there are absolutely different learning styles. And what is important for everyone here to understand is the differences in those learning styles doesn't make one better than the other. And once you accept that from an instructional standpoint, then the onus moves to you as an instructor to meet the students where they are.
And I know your instructors have had to do that a lot over the past year. Like many colleges, when the pandemic first hit, you sent your students home. Everyone was learning virtually. Bring us up to date. How are things now?
Things have worked well. I mean, one of the advantages that we had as an institution is that we were always on a hybrid model. We're an urban work college, so our students spent 15, 16 hours per week working in corporate internships and then also having to go to class. So the only way to really do that is to give the students the opportunity to take part of their classes in person and part of it hybrid. So the adjustment in teaching the students has worked out really, really well. And when the students get back, they will come back to a school where there are three new buildings, there are new academic programs. It'll just be a completely different experience because we made the best use of this time that we could.
You know, some homeowners have spent this time, you know, renovating and improving their houses. It sounds like you did the same on your campus during this period. But I want to come back to the work component that you mentioned, which I know is integral to your programming, and that some 85% of your students are eligible for Pell Grants, which means that many of your students are also trying to find jobs while they're attending school. That must have been somewhat harder, though, with so many businesses closed down during the pandemic. How is the work component of your education going?
Sure. No, that has been a challenge. We anticipated that that would be the case. And so we shifted as many students as possible into an additional training program that gives the students an opportunity to pick up experience in the computer programs that the students were going to need and in working on their emotional intelligence. But there really is no substitute for an internship. So we've done the best that we could do with that, but it's still a challenge.
I know that this Urban Work College program is one of the hallmarks of Paul Quinn College, and it has really helped some of your students take on the student debt problem, which is so big for so many students. And I understand it's actually reduced a student debt load from $40,000 to $15,000, and you're trying to drive that down even farther to $10,000. And if we look at the broader education landscape, in many cases, it's students of color who are taking on a lot of this debt. How do we recognize the urgency of this moment at a time when we have some federal lawmakers pushing for student loan forgiveness?
I look at it from the standpoint that when you're dealing with students from under-resourced communities, being the best caretaker of that trust that you can be means that you don't take advantage of them. We look at our students, and 85% of them are on Pell Grants. That means there's long-term underemployment and long-term unemployment. And because of that, you have to ask yourself, okay, if that's the case, who else in that home is watching cousins, brothers, sisters, and everyone is looking at the person who's able to make it, and they're saying, well, is this going to be worth it? And in order for it to be worth it, you've got to take a look at the whole picture. And a part of that is not leaving people with unmanageable debt and then routing them into careers where they'll never pay for it. We have a belief at Paul Quinn that you have to look at the eradication of poverty in an intergenerational fashion, right? And I tell a very personal story. My dad didn't go to college, right? He grew up in a single-parent home in New Orleans, Louisiana. So my mother went to college. She went to graduate school. Her mother went to college. Her mother went to graduate school. But when my parents got married, you know, they invested heavily in a business. It turned out to be incredibly successful. But because my father came home smelling like ribs every night, I never have come home smelling like ribs. In one generation, his sacrifice took us from a family where on his side, a dad who didn't go to college to a son who's a college president. And we have to have a realistic conversation with our students about what it is that they can afford to do in the short term.
Do you think then that this is a moment for admissions offices to consider reforming the college application process? Because even before the pandemic, many colleges were rethinking the value of things like standardized tests, the ACT, the SAT. Has the pandemic intensified those conversations in your view?
I mean, I think so. But let's be honest. I think who this will serve to harm are those students coming from places that need a little extra time, but have a gift. And that gift has manifested itself in a high test score. Now, I think you see a lot of schools right now who are saying, we're going to make it test optional. I don't see that being long term. I do think, however, there must be options. What I care most about is that talented students have an opportunity to develop in places that are going to invest deeply in them.
You know, I take your point on the standardized tests. I used to teach the SAT for the Princeton Review, and to your point, it can be an opportunity for a student from a high school that maybe has a poor academic profile to score highly on that test and impress an admissions officer who might have otherwise not given them a closer look. The last thing I'm curious about, President Sorrell, is just a broader reflection. I mean, you've been at the head of Paul Quinn College for almost 15 years. I mean, what have you seen in that time shift on the higher ed landscape? And how are you thinking about your students' future?
Oh, so much has shifted. You know, people don't know this, but the whole concept of wraparound services started in historically Black colleges and universities. Those schools were tasked with educating an entire race of people who had nothing. The only way forward were for these institutions to be everything to their students, hence wraparound services. I think that the conversation around debt has, in many ways, is operating as a disservice to some students because the pendulum has swung so far now that, you know, look, people should not be in soul-crushing amounts of debt. But you do need to understand the idea that this is an investment in you. And many students come to us now and they say, well, I don't want to take out any loans. Well, that's just not going to be possible. Maybe you need to take out $10,000 of loans to have a college education. That's
I be correct to assume that to work your way through Oberlin, Duke, and Penn that you had to take on some student loans yourself that paid off down the line?
Law school is where I picked up my debt. And you know what? That investment has paid off handsomely. I cannot complain.
Michael Sorrell is the president of Paul Quinn College, a historically Black college in Dallas, Texas. He joined us to talk about reimagining the college experience post-COVID and helping his students find jobs after graduation. President Sorrell, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You as well. You take care.
The federal government has delivered hundreds of billions of dollars to people during the pandemic using a familiar method, unemployment insurance. The latest relief bill extends those benefits for several more months, providing crucial support for people in need. But these huge flows of money have become a tempting target for scammers and cyber attackers who are using a stockpile of stolen identities to steal billions of dollars from state programs. In Colorado, the problem has manifested in a bizarre way for a retired contract delivery driver who's been locked in a months-long battle to try to stop scammers. His story reveals how states suffer from some fundamental flaws in their security systems. Colorado Public Radio's Andrew Kenny has the story.
Now, this is my mail slot right here. This is where the mail should come in through the outside.
That's Phil Jubik. On a video call, he's showing me how he usually gets his mail at his home in Pueblo, Colorado, because something unusual has been happening here for the last couple months. Jubik's mail won't fit through the slot anymore. Instead, he finds thick stacks on his front step, wrapped up in rubber bands.
When I get some of the stacks, they'll be piled there by my muddy work boots.
Almost every letter is from the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment. Dozens of envelopes.
Actually, dozens would be easy to handle. It's when I receive 95 in one day that they get a little difficult.
And each one is part of a scam, representing an unemployment claim by someone who is asking the state of Colorado to pay them unemployment benefits by claiming that they were laid off by this same guy, Phil Jubik.
I have gotten these claims for a chemist, a chemical engineer, a head chef, a boat engineer, a dentist.
In reality, Jubik is a retired, self-employed delivery driver. He has two corporations registered in his name, but he has never had an employee.
These people put down that they work 10 hours a week for me, up to 72 hours a week for me.
It's part of a national wave of fake unemployment claims. If no one notices, scammers can collect thousands of dollars per week from the government. At some point, a scammer apparently started using details about Jubik's corporations in their scheme. And at first, Jubik didn't understand how it was possible.
Kind of, it's strange, but, you know, I couldn't figure out how they could just make up names and social security numbers and stuff, and that would get through the system.
Then he realized that these identities in his mail aren't made up. They're real, and they were stolen.
Okay, here. Mays, Ferguson, Duncan.
When he Googled one name, he found a match in Illinois.
Schmierden,
Hawkins, Gerritsen.
He's counted more than 24 different identities. The same names appear again and again.
Dwayne Lowe. She was one of my first.
He laughs, but this stuff can have significant consequences. The person whose identity was stolen could be locked out of the unemployment system just when they need it. And someone named as their employer, even if it's fake, like in Phil Jubik's case, could be billed for the benefits if the fraud isn't caught.
I was worried about the repercussions to me and my family. You know, if the state comes back on me for these claims, takes my money, then it's me that's, you know, I'm out in the street.
Scammers are building these fraudulent identities using personal information that was stolen in data breaches, like the one at Equifax. Officials here in Colorado say they have counted more than 1 million suspected fake unemployment claims. Nationally, the Labor Department estimates that about 10% of the CARES Act unemployment money may have been misspent, much of it lost to fraud. Here's Andrew Stettner, an expert in unemployment with the Century Foundation.
So they have enough information to file something as, you know, John Smith in Seattle, Washington, based on your address, they know your social, your birth date, and your phone number.
And there's a huge financial incentive since the federal government has pumped billions of dollars into unemployment systems.
So it's become this target, weak link.
Colorado initially estimated it had lost about $4 million to unemployment fraud, but other states are reporting far higher numbers. In California, it's $11 billion, with a B. Phil Jubik decided to fight back by sending every contested claim back to the Labor Department. He even bought his own fax machine, even though not getting much response made him feel crazy.
All the instructions and videos said, make sure the faxes are facing up when you send them. I'm like, maybe I've just been sending blank sheets. I don't know, so.
The state says they're making improvements. They have an online form now that Jubik can use, and they're searching for suspicious patterns in applications. In the long run, governments will fundamentally change how they verify people's identities. Birth dates and social security numbers and mothers' maiden names will be obsolete. Instead, people may have to use things like video selfies to prove who they are. Eventually, back in Pueblo, Phil Jubik kind of got used to seeing those familiar stolen names in his mailbox.
They're like old friends, the names and the stuff. So, I mean, the anger's gone. I mean, it's just something I do now.
He hasn't had to pay any bills from the unemployment department yet, but he's still getting a dozen new claims a week. And with months more unemployment benefits in the pipeline from the latest stimulus, this fight is far from over. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Kenny.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.